It's all about food. And I am actually in Florida and ready to do the show from here. It's been really a great tour. I premiered the Swinging Gourmets last week, which was really fun. And now I'm in Florida doing a number of talks at a variety of places. And it's always fun to meet the community and the people that are interested in food the way I am. Okay, so interesting show today. I'm looking forward to getting started. So let's do that. Why don't we? My first guest is Dr. Ismael Nuño, and he's the author of a book, The Spirit of the Heart. He has had a 35-year career as one of America's leading heart surgeons, and throughout his career, he has experienced his fair share of loss and triumph. He details his incredible journey as a heart surgeon in his new book, The Spirit of the Heart, Stories of Family, Hope, Loss, and Healing. Dr. Nuño, are you with us?
Yes, ma'am. I am
Hi.
In Los Angeles, and I am hearing you from Florida.
You know, it's crazy. I love technology. It brings us all together. It's a good thing and a bad thing. You know, I talk about this all the time, and what we really need is balance. But I love the way I can speak to people all over the world.
Absolutely.
Okay, I read your book, and I really was touched by all your intimate thoughts about your career and the people that you connected with. And it's really it's a fascinating thing doing heart surgery.
Yes, it is. I wanted to do heart surgery ever since I was a kid. My entire life was oriented towards one day becoming a heart surgeon. My high school projects, science projects were on the heart. My papers in college were in the heart. Mm-hmm. And my training in surgery was in the heart. And it was a very fulfilling career. We operated in a lot of patients, saved a lot of lives. We lost some.
Sure.
But there was learning in that. So that's why I wanted to produce a book. And the most important part of it was losing an 18-year-old daughter.
Yeah. I cannot imagine what that feels like. And I imagine just writing about it and sharing your thoughts and keeping her spirit alive is somewhat helpful.
Yes, it is. It was very I brought back a lot of memories. I keep on thinking about it. I can now speak with other parents who are having the same problems with their children.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very, very, very beneficial. So even though she's not with me physically, I keep her in my heart, and I talk to her and deal with her and, you know, get angry at her still. So,
well, one of the things that I enjoyed about your book, there were a number of things, but one was the fact that you were open to some metaphysical thoughts about spirits leaving and connecting, which I think is so important, especially in the medical profession, because so many doctors turn off to that possibility because there's no scientific evidence for it.
Right. It's difficult to talk even amongst colleagues when you sit there having a cup of coffee and you're discussing certain events. They look at you like, yeah, you're nuts. And you're absolutely correct. You know, they do turn it off, but I think that those of us who are in the business, we really learn to respect the sensitivity of not only a life, but a death, you know, just in a mm-hmm. blink of an eye. I opened up the book with my sister. We were flying to Paris, and her heart stopped, and I had to resuscitate her 35,000 feet. Luckily, things turned out well for her, but it's a blink of an eye. And that's exactly what happens when a family takes a loved one for heart surgery and everything is going well and you're patting yourself on the back and everything turned out fine. And then all of a sudden their heart stops, and it promotes an entire philosophy, not only existential but spiritually. What happens, I'm not talking about really what happens after death. I know nothing about it. And like you said, it's not scientifically proven, but there is a transition as you go from life to death that I think can be a very, in a way, beautiful aspect of it. When a patient I know is going to die, and they're dying, and bring the family in, they can touch them, they can tell them how much they love them, and there is a lot to that that we ordinarily miss. When you have the loss, which is sudden, that's horrible, and everybody understands that, but if you know that it's coming, then I think that you can make appropriate changes in that moment so that you can help that person, put them at ease, tell them that you love them. And what's a better way of leaving this life than knowing that you have loved ones around you? I asked my wife, I said, when your time comes, if you had a choice of time and place, how would you do it? And she said, I would love to have my grandchildren around my bed.
Yeah, and you had mentioned how many hospitals don't want young children in the presence of people who are sick.
Right. For a couple of things, a couple of reasons. One of them is the fact that we used to have the epidemiologic thought that a child was a harbinger of a lot of viruses, and if you brought them in, they could create an epidemic and that sort of thing. And so there were hospital policies against the child coming in. I really believe that a child can bring a lot of happiness to a person that it's gravely ill, especially if they can make the contact and they're not in a coma. But even in a coma, you never really know how much people are taking it in. The patient is going to take in the love that comes from the family.
That's right. Well, I know that when I'm around small children, even if I'm in a bad mood, all of a sudden my mood changes. Young children, sure. We can learn so much from them, and we forget how to be like children, and we really should pay more attention to their childlike manner where everything is new and fresh and joyful.
I agree entirely.
Yeah. Now, another thing that I liked is when you talked about seeing the other side as a patient. A friend of mine, Dr. Robert Klitzman, wrote a book, When Doctors Become Patients. And I think it's something that doctors need to learn in their education, becoming a doctor, what it's like to be a patient, because there's so much arrogance. And and the patients do not benefit from it.
Yes, I agree with you entirely. I learned a lot being in the hospital and just observing the way I was treated, and the poking and the needles and the attitude that some of them had. It was truly a learning experience. And when I was told that I was going into liver failure and that I was up for a liver transplant, it was so bizarre, Karen. Sitting there all night waiting for somebody to die so that I could have their liver.
Yes.
It was an incredible experience. And when morning came, I realized, I didn't die, number one. Number two, nobody gave me their liver, which was a good sign. And I learned a lot, and some of these moments when the sun comes up and you're thinking about your own life and your own mortality. They're beautiful moments, and moments that you just never forget.
I've done a bit of reading about transplants, and maybe you're familiar with this, but I've heard incredible stories about how there is memory not just in the brain, but in all parts of our body. And people who have transplants sometimes experience the memory of the person that they got their organ from.
You know, when you take a look at couples, all of us, you know, throughout the world, you begin to observe that perhaps the male begins to look like the female and the female mm-hmm. begins to look like the male, you know? It's
yeah.
like all of us that have dogs, the dog has a certain characteristics that our character has. But my thought is that through intimacy, for example, you are going to transfer cells from one body, from one organism to the other, and those cells are going to replicate, which is the basis for stem cells. You take a few, originating cells, and they develop into an organ, and that's what can happen between human beings, such that the wife can give her cells to the male, and I think that's how it's going to develop. Same thing with transplants. When we used to put in the organs into patients, and eventually they would develop certain traits that were different. And I had women ask me if their husband was going to develop the perhaps an ugly, mad character that the originating patient had. It's hard to say that, but I think there are some changes that are going to go through that. Now, technically, what we do is we wash out this organ so that we wash out a lot of the cells that would be debris and go into the organism so that there is no host or organ against the host. So, yeah, that can happen. I believe in that.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. Well, there are clearly so many things that we don't know. But in you've had a long career as a heart surgeon, 35 years. I imagine things have changed incredibly over those 35 years.
Yes. Number one, the most common surgery that was performed in the United States up until recently was coronary artery bypass. And when I began, we were making cuts from the neck to the abdomen and from the groin to the ankle. And there were huge, huge cuts. And now we have technology by which, thank God we have it, through a small little hole, you can do the bypass, you can take out the leg vein, and so there's a lot of new advances that are putting us in the right place. We do robotic surgery through small little holes, and pretty soon we're going to, once we work out this litigious aspect that we have in America, a surgeon in Los Angeles or New York can be doing, the telemetry surgery in another city or country. And that's going to come hopefully in a short while from now. We just have to work out some bugs from it.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? It's just mind-boggling and we know that it's going to happen, and it's going to happen soon.
Yeah, it's progressive. we're going to get there.
All right. Now, we know that there are over 600,000 deaths from heart disease every year. I think it's 650,000. It's probably increasing. And there are many, many people that suffer from a type 2 adult onset diabetes. And my passion is food. And we're learning more and more about the power of food and how it can prevent and often reverse heart disease and diabetes. You never mention food in your book.
No, but it's a very important aspect of it. I learned a lot through my daughter as she was fighting anorexia nervosa. number one. Number two, as a heart surgeon, I do recommend certain diets. One of them is the Mediterranean diet, which is very good in the societies of cardiology in America. I just voted it as the most preventive and health-wise diet for cardiovascular disease, which is a mixture of fish and some white meat with nuts, vegetables, and a little bit of red wine. So the American Heart Association recommends about 4 ounces of wine a day. You can go up to 8 ounces, but you got to be careful about it. But yeah, there are certain diets that we do recommend for cardiovascular health, and in the long run, it has created some improvements in longevity in patients that are studied. So there's a lot to be said about that for diets and the way that we, you have to recommend exercise, of course, which is a very important aspect of heart health. But we can do better in America and throughout the world in as far as improving or decreasing the number of deaths from heart disease just by diet.
Well, yeah, I think we definitely can do a lot of improvement. And the thing is that our technology is so incredible and so advanced, and we can do so much. And what frustrates me is that we can be doing much more for diseases that we know are not preventable, and take that technology and use it for those things like paralysis and other things where people have accidents or some really bizarre diseases. But heart disease, I personally don't think the Mediterranean diet is the best diet. And I don't, I'm a vegan, and I come from the plant strong world. And I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn, who wrote Preventing Heart Disease. And there's a documentary called Forks Over Knives. But there's this big movement now to focus on the power of plant foods and how it can really reverse heart disease. It's, and I really think that that's some of where we're really going to improve in the future. I mean, I hope so, because those things are easy.
I think we will. I think that it's up to us as physicians and, people like you helping, and trying to put the word out that that it can be done. I was president of the American Heart Association, and I stood up one day in the conference room and I said, people, we're dealing with a lot of the population that they, when they go to the store, they're going to get milk and bread for their kids. And that's it. That's what they care about, feeding their kids. I mean, those of us who are a little bit better off socioeconomically, yes, we do take a look at the labels and the calories and the nitrates and all of that. But I think that that there's a lot of room, like you said, so we can push it. And there are vegetarian diets that I think will help us, and you're in a better position to tell me that, if you have any particular suggestions.
Yes, well, there's two great books out. One is called The End of Diabetes by Dr. Joel Fuhrman, and he talks from a really detailed perspective. I had him on the show a few weeks ago about medication and how some of it actually increases cardiovascular disease and the things that you can do to really, if you have type 1 diabetes, to reduce your insulin requirement, and if you have type 2, how you can totally turn it around. It's really fascinating.
Excellent.
Powerful stuff.
Excellent.
And yeah. And I had a few other questions I want to talk about. This, you mentioned privilege, how some of us have more privilege and we can choose better foods. But also in the medical environment, there's a great deal of privilege. And I remember you mentioned when you were an intern, I think, or a new physician, and you had to take someone off life support and you wanted to resuscitate him, but his choice was do not resuscitate.
Correct, yes.
And I wonder about those who don't have access to great health care. They end up just dying. And then those who have access to good health care have a choice. They could not be resuscitated, or they could have all kind be put on all kinds of machines to keep them going.
Yes, absolutely. The advanced directive, you can write one as you go into the hospital, whether you want a tube or medication, and, you know. And I think that we've gotten to the point where we can be selective. The only problem is the degree of information that patient has. It's our duty to make sure that they understand fully, you know, what they're getting into. And we as children of parents, I don't think that we have that hard of a choice when we see if they're suffering, if their life has become so limited. We can say, okay, that's enough, stop it, let them be at peace. You know, for our children, I think it's a lot different. I think that we're learning a lot from the cancer patients, mm-hmm. how their survival now is getting better, thank God. I think it's great, and I think that, you know, the choices that we're having to make for our younger patients, the children, are getting better. So we're learning, we're getting better, and I think that we're going in the right direction.
You know, another thing you mentioned was that early on in your career, you put in very long hour days, and now there are more restrictions about doctors spending so much time in the hospital because it's not good for anybody. Everybody gets tired.
you do.
But there's all kinds of things in hospitals. You know, we're seeing so much, these viruses and the hygiene problems. Do you see some hope there and some, because some say that the second greatest cause of death is hospital care.
Yes, absolutely. Don't go into the hospitals. They're dirty. They really are. It's an accumulation of pus and, you know, all the terrible things that are around, especially some of the viruses. I'm a Republican by vote. We won't talk about politics, but as a physician, I do have to understand the Obamacare that's coming, how we're going to best deliver it to the patients, you know, how we're going to take care of them from now on. And one of the directions that we're going is to decrease the size of hospitals and to have as much as we can care as an outpatient. And so we are going to have to reinvent the machines, the care for some of these patients, such that we can deliver it at home. And we're going to have a series of healthcare delivery agents, to go out to their homes and take care of them. So things are going to change, and it's coming. There's no question about it. I think that it's going to be redistributed such that, you know, all this infections that you hear about, well, you know, they went in for open heart surgery and they got staff at the hospital. That's a terrible thing you hear about, well, you know, they went in for open heart surgery and they got staff at the hospital. That's a terrible thing. You know, mm-hmm. I can't imagine being more sorrowful than to think that I made the cut. It's my patient, and my patient came in better situation that I left him in. You know, it's a huge promise, and sometimes the promise is broken, and it's a terrible thing to happen.
The last thing I wanted to talk about is love, because I believe above all else, love heals. And yes. It's so important to have love, be surrounded by supportive friends and family. And it's really magical at some point. I remember reading in your book when you talked about this wife who brought a rabbi in to speak to our husband, Larry, who was not stable. And then all of a sudden he was stable. It's kind of, you really have to realize there's so much more that's bigger and greater than all of us out there when you see something like that happen.
Absolutely.
My prescription for you, Dr. Nuño, is lots of dark leafy green vegetables, onions, mushrooms, raw nuts, and seeds.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food.
I will take your advice. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Go forward then.
All the best with your book.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Well, there you go. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you are listening to It's All About Food. Now, you know, you can call into this show if you have any comments or questions, and the number is 1-888-874-4888. I don't say that very often because I usually get wrapped up talking to my guests, but I'm always happy to hear from you. And you certainly can send me an email at info@realmeals.org. And if any of you are in the South Florida area, I am going to be speaking this Friday night. I'm looking right now for the information. May 3rd, it's a vegan potluck for Earth Save Miami at the Tamarack Community Center. You can find out all the specifics if you visit my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, and click on the Talks tab. That's going to be a lot of fun. And lots of information out there about heart disease. We talked a while ago about this new study that came out linking carnitine and how it changes into something, what are the initials? Something like TMAO or T, you know what I'm talking about. But it develops arteriosclerosis, and there's all kinds of back and forth conversation about this now because there are people that don't want to know that their meat and eggs might be causing arteriosclerosis and now having more scientific proof on that subject. But, you know, when it all comes down to health, for me, it's dark leafy green vegetable scientific proof on that subject. But, you know, when it all comes down to health, for me, it's dark leafy green vegetables. And when you have, because people have been asking me about it and aren't sure where to find it. So I just put it right back front and center on the front page. It's all about juicing, blending, what's the difference, steam greens, salads. Just get more greens in your diet. And remember, there's nothing kale can't do. Okay, let's take a break. And we're going to be back and talking with Harold Brown of Farmkind. So a few more minutes and we'll be right back.